Today we talk with two LA authors in the struggle and trying to expand our conversations to be real, inclusive, and to transform the way we treat each other. Randy Jurado Ertil is an activist, teacher, journalist, and author of three works of nonfiction, which chronicle the plight of Salvadoran Americans and his own work as an activist. And he's written a remarkable novel, The Lives and Times of El Cepedo, inspired by Salvadoran folklore. His latest book is In the Struggles, and we'll talk with Randy a little later in this episode. In a minute, we'll meet Jamie B. Hansen, whose book is Expanding the Conversation, because real leaders leverage gender differences to create a competitive advantage in business. In the wake of sexual harassment scandals, this is a timely book and conversation. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Jamie B. Hansen has had a career in economic consulting with an MBA from Duke University. During a 10-year span in the tech sector, Hansen acknowledged more and more that women were not in the forefront of leadership and entrepreneurship, nor driving development and innovation. This led to her speaking and speaking out in videos and articles, and with her latest book. Let's listen to our conversation. Jamie B. Hansen, welcome. It's so good to be able to talk with you today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Your book is Expanding the Conversation because real leaders leverage gender differences to create a competitive advantage in business. And really, every enterprise, business, government, healthcare, corporations, radio stations, all function under a hierarchy of sorts. So the conversation you're wanting to generate is appropriate really across all sectors of our society, but you focus particularly on business and entrepreneurs. And I wonder what your take is and why that focus.
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. So I think you're right. I think the conversation is relevant in all sectors. I call out business specifically, primarily because of the fairness aspect, I would say, the equality. So when we're talking about gender and whether it's quotas or equal representation or different perspectives, I think there is a difference between, for example, a nonprofit or politics that have more of a duty to represent the broader population or make sure that everyone has an equal say, an equal voice as well, right?
Yeah.
Versus business, for-profit business, and I should probably specify with capitalistic business, you know, by definition, their responsibility is really to their employees and to the shareholders, right? And they are concerned about a bottom line. And with respect to that, like, business isn't necessarily fair, and nobody promised that it would be. That said, I mean, I think it's imperative that there's different diversity and different diverse perspectives in business. I just think that doing so because of equality or fairness is not the right reason. So I think it's a different conversation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Also in your book, you seem to focus a lot on millennials.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you refer to them as future leaders, really. And
yeah.
I'm wondering how you see or what is it that millennials have, or what kind of different perspective does that bracket bring to business, the workplace, and to our culture in general? And where does that difference come from?
Yeah, I mean, well, this could be a long show. But, you know, I think millennials, they're a totally different breed, right? And a lot has been said about the millennial generation. And honestly, some of it not so good. I personally think that some of the negative representation of the millennials really has nothing to do with that generation. It's just youth. I mean, when you're 20, you're a different person than you are when you're 40, regardless of what generation you're part of. But that said, I do think that these millennials are really different than the generations that have come before them in a lot of really good ways. And part of that is the way that they grew up, right? So, you know, the no-brainer is they grew up with technology. Like, they're just, it's secondhand to them, second nature. They're just really customized with it, which is great. They also grew up with choices. So it was not just, you know, do you want milk or chocolate milk with your cereal, I guess, right? It was, do you want milk or low-fat milk or almond milk or coconut milk or, you know, the 25 different kinds of milk that we now have. And they got really used to different choices and different possibilities. And I think that coupled with the technology piece really opens up the world, right? They have a bad rap in some ways of being entitled. I don't really see them as being entitled. I see them as seeing the possibilities of everything is possible if you just more or do it differently, which I think is really exciting.
And do you think that that generation also has a different social perspective with regard to gender?
I do, yeah. But to me, it seems like the millennials are very fluid in their, you know, perceptions of things. They don't, from what I've observed, they don't really care if you're male, if you're female, if you're young, if you're old, if you're black, if you're white, like none of it matters as long as you're being authentic. And I think that we see that in terms of the people that they respect and where they gravitate towards. So I actually say in the book at one point that millennials can smell BS like a mile away. And I think it's true. Like, and they're not into that at all. I think it's the reason why, you know, even when you look at the performers that they love, they love Beyonce, they love the Kardashians and Kanye, who are crazy in some ways, but they're authentically themselves. They don't have to be like them as long as they're like, okay, you're owning who you are, and they can appreciate that.
And in the book, you talk a lot about leadership.
Yeah.
And emerging leadership or cultivating leadership. How do you personally define some of the qualities of a good leader?
Ooh, that is such a good question. So I think it really differs. So in my former jobs in corporate, I was always typically in business development and strategy. And I worked a lot primarily with different partners and alliances throughout the globe. So it was a great opportunity to really see different leadership styles, and they do differ. What I saw worked the best, I guess the good qualities were, you know, one is really listening. There is, I think we can all identify, there is a huge difference between a leader that really likes to talk and hear themselves speak, and it's their way or the highway, versus a leader that, you know, has a vision and a strategy and wants to lead a company or an organization, but also is willing to listen and accept feedback and change and adapt their vision based on that. So I think the listening is a huge piece of it, but I think almost even more, and this is such a buzzword, is this authenticity, where a leader that is themselves with their own style and, you know, their own way of doing things, regardless if it's traditional or atypical, will always resonate more with their audience. And it's because it's something genuine. Like, people can really see that and feel that. And when they can own their own mistakes with that and be authentic and say, I screwed up, or look, I realize that the whole rest of the company thinks this way, but guys, I think this way and I'm the leader of the company, so we're going that way. That transparency, that authenticity is to me what makes the best leaders.
It is not a word to shy away from. We also build a lot of artifice in our culture and society that masks that authenticity. So
you're right.
You know, and I think that is the source of a lot of problems in business and in our culture.
I completely agree with that. I do. And I think that's really the conversation we want to expand, right? Because we've been doing that for so long. And so when you think about it, it's almost become, that's the norm. And yet, so none of these, you know, the numbers that we're looking at, the statistics, not only are they so low, you know, for women in business and minorities and diversity inclusion, but they're also stagnant. So it has to make you question, okay, what are we doing that needs to be changed, right? Or that we need to modify? And I do think a huge piece of that is we're just continuously creating something that isn't real. Like, that's the sort of pretense that doesn't feel authentic.
since you brought up diversity, in your book you say, diversity is about different perspectives and alternative viewpoints, and that is what builds a healthy, robust enterprise. But you seem to mark or define diversity as qualities, human qualities, and qualities of expression rather than associated necessarily with gender or race.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, certainly, you know, there's, I call them like demographic diversity things, whether that's gender, race, age, you know, ethnicity, whatever. And those are still diverse traits, right? I call them shallow diverse traits. They are an indication of diversity. They're sort of an easy swap, which is why I look at gender, because frankly, it's, you know, approximately 50-50 of the population. So it's a good place to start. But at the end of the day, we all know that you could pick a room full of 10 men or a room of 10 women or whatever that could be totally diverse in their thinking. It's just a question of like, how deep can you get, right? Mm-hmm. And it's harder to get to the depth of that. So I think taking the shallow demographic pieces is the easiest place to start.
You know, it's such a hard nut to crack. And right now,
it is.
Where we are just in our society right now, and we just have to look at current events to see that we have a lot of friction. We witness it in the public sphere and on the news. There's denigration of women by men, and that goes all the way up to the top leadership in our own country. And I just wonder how or what you say should be an approach when gender-based manipulation and denigration takes place in many ways. And how do we get at that? How do we expand the conversation as you're asking us to do when there still is so much of this bad treatment of women?
You know, it is. It's exactly like you said. It is so difficult. It's a really big challenge. And that's why I wrote the book specifically calling it Expanding the Conversation, because I think the first part has to be a conversation that is open and honest and more broadly defined than what it's been to date. You know, if we have a bunch of, for example, in this gender conversation, a bunch of women that feel strongly about this and can see this as you and I are talking about it, speaking to each other, that's great, but that's not necessarily going to make any changes, right? Because like we discussed, there's, you know, half the population is men. You look at our country specifically, and you're right, to the tops of our country, the leadership, you have people that are really going against everything we're talking about. But the reality is these people are in power, whether it's politics or business or other organizations. And if we don't make them a part of the conversation, you're not going to convert everybody, right? Not everyone's going to change. But if you don't at least include them in the conversation to hear different points of view and to try to turn them or try to help explain or come to some understanding where they can at least see the different perspectives, then I don't think any change is going to happen.
And it seems that when a woman walks into a workplace, that how you dress, how you speak, you almost have to have a higher standard of excellence and not back down. And
yeah.
I wonder if women still are not being, I want to say, trained or nurtured to do that, to have the strength to do that. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought this up, because I've been thinking about this so much lately. And I think that there are almost two different fronts to face these challenges head on with, right? And I think, you know, one is the future. So looking forward to kind of what you said, like, are women being trained in a certain way? So like, take it even, you know, further, like when you look at our children, right? Or kids in junior high, you know, middle school, whatever, at this point, are they being taught, what are they being taught, and how can that help shape them as future adults and employees and workers and leaders?
So one thing, this whole notion of equality and equal rights. And I think what you're saying is that, well, having equal rights in the workplace is different than men and women having to be the same and having to act yeah. the same. So let's talk about the differences that women can bring into an organization that maybe on the surface people don't necessarily recognize as assets. What do you think yeah. some of them are?
I mean, I think there's several, but, you know, the top ones that always, you know, kind of come up in conversation that people most think of, I think, and again, I'm totally generalizing, so this is not to say that all women have this or that all men don't. I think that women tend to be more empathetic, and I think that's not just having compassion for people, but being better listeners and really taking it in to recognize how those around them are feeling and or responding to different things. And I think that's a huge asset. I also think there is, you know, where I'll give a yin and a yang, where men are often very good at diving deep with focus, laser focus, you know, straight at something. Women tend to see things more from like a 360 purview. So, and this, you know, it's not really that surprising when you think about how female adults today have been raised. They have a lot of things going on typically. They're responsible. They have a lot of responsibilities, and they can see different perspectives on different angles of any given situation. And that actually can be a huge advantage in business, as well as can the laser focus be. But that's a perfect example of, I think, complementary assets between men and women that can really add a more robust picture.
And that there doesn't necessarily have to be a competition going yeah. on with these kind of traits.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. Like, it's not, and that's to your point, like, I feel like the media and the public have really, you know, put that out there that it's an either or, and it has to be this way or that way. And I think that's such a disservice to both genders, because I think it's the and that really makes things better when you could actually have both. I mean, the ideal is that everybody has all of these traits, right? Or the capabilities to do them. But when we can start combining them and using them in a complementary fashion, it shouldn't be competitive at all.
Yeah, I'll just bring up a metaphor to the family. I mean, that's really very much how a family functions, and that a mother is the ultimate manager and executive, yeah. especially when there are children involved, and when there's discipline, and when there's nurturing, and that sort of thing. Yet, I think that if we say that these qualities of motherhood translate into being a good executive, that it gets to another issue you bring up in your book, and that's one of language, and yeah. that maybe being a mom is not what a corporation wants at the head, but it's probably what it needs.
So. Yeah, no, it's a great point. There's been so much research done on what they call the mom tax, and that it's interesting because as you get further up in your career, there tends to be a point where if you are a mom, and especially if you showcase that, if that's known, there's a quote-unquote tax where it hurts your career because people have preconceived notions of what that means. Typically, it's like, okay, at some point, one of the kids are going to get sick and you're not going to be able to attend this or do your responsibilities, or you're going to be distracted about all the things that are going on that you need to take care of at home, right? Ironically, there's no dad tax. Anything in today's world, people in business tend to see fatherhood as like they notch it up a little bit. They're like, oh, you do all this amazing stuff professionally and you're a great dad to your family. Right? And yet it's exactly what you said. It's that language and it's that nuance. Like, let's reframe this. Like, look at what in today's world, if the mom is the nucleus, the manager, I love how you said that, of her household, like that should absolutely, those skills definitely translate to a business environment, right? Like so many of those skills. And yet that's not what's being touted. And I think that's really interesting.
And maybe you could just expand a little bit on because you do talk a lot about language in the book and yeah, yeah. in the workplace, how even positive attributes maybe need to be reframed.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. This is, I'm very big into language and words. I think it bothers me when people take the easy way out with language, because I'm like, we're so blessed. We have so many wonderful words. Take the time to figure out the right one for the right situation. So I'll give you an easy example that I often use. You have a word like creative. If someone is creative, that's a positive attribute, right? It's good. People are putting that on their resumes. People are talking about that. Oh, I'm really creative. It's a good thing. And yet, in business, creative has become very associated with a sort of whimsical, light, childlike essence. And, I mean, I have my own theory that I think we can thank Crayola for that, which is an amazing marketing campaign. But, people start to think of sometimes marketing, which is great, but it's more, it's colorful. It's, you know, like I said, it's sort of like in, it's fun, very, very childlike in its, in what it makes you think of. And at the same time, you flip the switch and now you use the word innovative, almost the exact same meaning as creative. And now all of a sudden, that's a quality that's revered in business, right? Steve Jobs was innovative. He was at the height of innovation. You look at any of these companies today, innovative is one of the highest compliments that you can pay a leader. Again, means the same thing as creative, but has a very different context and people think very differently about them. And I think we tend to think of women as creative, meaning they're not analytical or not something, which again is totally wrong because it's the or versus the and. Yet innovative allows for a more strategic context, which puts that all together.
Language matters.
Yeah, it does.
I think that it's something that we always need to be thoughtful of. But you opened my eyes a little bit just in your discussion in the book, and I really appreciated it.
Oh, good. So glad. Thank you.
Jamie B. Hansen, the book is Expanding the Conversation, because real leaders leverage gender differences to create a competitive advantage in business. And I wonder who you see as the target audience for the book.
You know, initially, I really set out, I was very intentional that I did not want this book to just be for women. I obviously want women to read it. I think it's a great book for women. But I want men to read it, too. I see it as a book for men and women, but really current and future leaders. So it's anyone that sees things and sort of wants to see them differently or wants to take an active, intentional role in their own life and also the design of their teams and their companies.
Well, I think you're doing some good work, and thank you so much for joining us today, and all the best in your future endeavors.
Thanks for having me, Suzanne. I really appreciate it.
That was my conversation with Jamie B. Hansen. Visit her online, and her book is Expanding the Conversation, because real leaders leverage gender differences to create a competitive advantage in business. In just a minute, we will meet with Randy Jurado Ertil, a Salvadoran-American activist and author. Please stay with us. It's KRCB's A Novel Idea. Let's listen to Pink with Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken from her album, Beautiful Trauma. Enjoy.
I will have to die for this, I fear. There's rage and terror and there's sickness here. I fight because I have to. I fight for us to know the truth. There's not enough rope to tie me down. There's not enough tape to shut this mouth. The stones you throw can make me bleed, but I won't stop until we're free. Wild hearts can't be broken. No, wild hearts can't be broken. This is my rally cry. I know it's hard, we have to try. Share is not a sin. There's not enough rope to tie me down. There's not enough tape to shut this mouth. The stones you throw can make me bleed, but I won't stop until we're free. 'Cause wild hearts can't be broken. No, wild hearts can't be broken. You beat me, betray me. You're losing, we're winning. My spirit above me, you cannot deny me. My freedom is burning. This broken world keeps turning. I'll never surrender. There's nothing but a victory. There's not enough rope to tie me down. Shut this mouth. The stones you throw can make me bleed, but I won't stop until we're free. Wild hearts can't be broken. Wild hearts can't be broken. This wild heart can't be broken.
That was Pink and Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken from her album, Beautiful Trauma. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Randy Gerardo Ertil was born in the United States. His mother was deported back to her native El Salvador and took Randy with her when he was still an infant. Randy's fate was not dissimilar to many Salvadorans who fled the strife in their own country and narrowly found safety and security in this one. Randy's latest book is In the Struggles, Chronicles and Columns. And this follows his other works, The Life of an Activist, In the Frontlines 24/7, and Hope in the Time of Darkness, A Salvadoran-American Experience. Randy has one novel, The Surreal Life and Times of El Cepedo, inspired by the Salvadoran folk legend of Cepedo, an illegitimate young boy whose feet are backwards and is cursed to immortality as a little boy. Here is my conversation with Randy Gerardo Ertil. We began by talking about his early life. Tell us a little bit about that whole experience of your mother being deported and you having to go back there.
When I was 8 months old, my mother was arrested and deported because her visa had expired. Because she came here to the United States from El Salvador in 1968, and then I was born in 72, and she was deported, and I had to leave with her. So I grew up in El Salvador till I was 5 years old, and I grew up in the city and also in the rural countryside area.
You were with your family back there, and it seems like that was a good time in your life.
It was more of a childhood experience, but at the same time, I think it helped shape how I viewed the world. Through nature, but also through the struggle of the Salvadoran people. I got to see it firsthand. And my grandmother, she was very loving, and I became really close to her because she actually helped to raise me because my mother returned to work here in the U.S., and she left me there. So I practically grew up with my grandmother, so she was a major influence on me. And she helped to raise many, many grandchildren because a lot of mothers had to leave El Salvador like in the 70s, 80s, especially in the 80s because of the war. And also they wanted to provide for their families. So a lot of children came, I would say, motherless and fatherless. And they created a lot of issues because a lot of the kids came and didn't have the bonding or the experience. Like me, I had to reconnect with my mom because when she returned, I really didn't see her as my mom because I had disconnected. And I didn't feel comfortable even calling her mom, because my grandma, we used to call her Mama Gume, so she became like our mother. So that, I would say, happened to thousands upon thousands of children that were actually left with the grandparents with the Civil War that started in 1980.
The war was, in fact, why a lot of people did flee El Salvador, and for that economic stability, as your mother did. Then your mother sent for you. She came back and got you and brought you back into this country and into the United States. And it seems like then you were not quite American, and also you didn't speak the language. And so that put you at a little bit of a disadvantage when you got to school, correct?
Yes. Also because I didn't fit the, I would say, the profile of how an immigrant kid from Central America is supposed to look, because I'm very light-skinned. And I think I used to confuse people, especially because I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. And in the late 70s and in the 80s, it was majority black. And we were one of the first, I would say, Latino immigrant families that moved among the black community. And that was a big influence for me. They had to learn from me, and I had to learn from them. And I actually learned English from my first grade black teacher and classmates. So it was quite interesting because I was used to nature. And then we moved to the concrete jungle of South Central. And at that time, it was pretty violent. And I had to learn of the dynamics of how we get treated or profiled based on skin color and also language and accents. And I had to go through all of that to be accepted. And it took a long time, but I think I was able to overcome those issues.
Yes, it sounds like you overcame a lot. And you know, if you mention South Central to most people, there is this stereotypical kind of reaction of it being a very violent place and a very tough place and a very gang-ridden place. And I wonder how it is now.
It's gotten a little better. Demographically, it's the other way around now. Latinos are the majority, especially Latino immigrants from Central America and Mexico. But it's still pretty unsafe. I mean, just yesterday there was a shooting where a mother was killed, and her 3 and 5-year-old children were in the car, and her husband was wounded. So there is a lot of violence, not as before, because before it was pretty endemic and chronic. And I think that now it's a little, I would say it's a little better. It could be better, but the poverty is still there. There's still lack of jobs, and it's not like an area that it's safe to walk or to catch the bus.
And is there still a heavy gang presence?
Yeah, there is. That's what's interesting, that the 70s, 80s, a lot of the gangs, they're still there. Some of them have moved to different areas because they have their little territory warfares like they're having in Chicago. But what's interesting and fascinating is that certain gangs get kicked out by other gangs that are new or older or more violent. So that cycle is still there.
You could have gone in that direction yourself. Certainly there were a lot of angry young men and getting involved with gangs at the time you were growing up, but you didn't follow that path. So something made a difference in your life that took you in a different direction.
Yeah, I think it was probably a few of my friends who helped to keep me away from that, because I was borderline. I was like almost heading in that direction, because the survival of the fittest, and that's what you do to survive. And in a way, I got lucky because a few of my friends, when I was about to join, they stopped me from doing it. And then I thank them for that to this day. So sometimes one or two people can really make a difference in preventing that. But then the majority of my friends, they did go that route. And now they're dead. They're in prison for life. They have felonies. A lot of them were deported. So it was really hard to resist, but I'm glad I was able to do that, because I always felt that it was easier to become part of that and become a gang member and then hurt your own community, hurt your own people. But I was able to see it, and I knew it was something that wasn't positive, that it was negative power. And I think that what really saved me was when I went to Rochester, Minnesota, because I received a scholarship, and that helped me to leave South Central LA, because a lot of kids, you're borderline in middle school, but also when you go into high school, there's still a lot of pressure. So I'm glad I was able to leave, really, to not fall into that pattern.
And your leaving was a direct pathway for you to being absorbed in education. And in fact, through a thread running through your writing too, is that education is really the key for breaking that cycle.
Yeah, I think it's one of the keys, and it's hard now to say that, because a lot of times, a lot of kids try. They try in certain areas, including South Central, and they do get an education, but then the opportunities are not there. So it does help, but it's becoming harder to reach the American dream because things have become tougher now. Like, the economy's not well, so and people are competing for the minimal resources and minimal jobs. So it's one avenue to try to escape, you know, that violence and poverty. But I think for people like us from South Central, that struggle never ends, and that's why I've written about it, because it always follows you, so you always have to keep one step ahead, because the system has been set up to incarcerate and criminalize black and brown kids, and get profiled and tracked once you're in school, because once you get in trouble, they start tracking you. They put you on a database. The police department knows, because of technology now, it's even more easily done. So they, instead of creating opportunities or jobs or scholarships, what has been done is the schools to prison pipeline, which is really true, because it's a moneymaker with the private prison industry. And I think finally, like a couple of years ago, people got it, that was being done intentionally. Because I always felt that the targeting, the harassment, the surveillance has always been done intentionally. And it's really to incarcerate black and brown kids and to make them lifelong criminals by giving you a felony. I mean, you can't get a job anymore. Once you have a felony, you're pretty much a slave for life, because you have to take menial jobs that will never get you out of poverty.
And what you're talking about now is also some of what you talk about in this latest book, In the Struggle Chronicles. And the book is a chronological presentation of a lot of your editorial writing, both in Spanish and in English. And really, reading the book, it's a modern history, really, of our culture, especially for Californians, but it certainly radiates well beyond that. And how timely, when we are facing such a immigration crisis right now, especially with the current administration in Washington. So I wondered, you know, you have lived the life of an activist, and you continue to speak truth to power. And it seems like that's something that that we need more of. And something that I was really struck by was how much we as Americans really look at a Hispanic culture as very monolithic in a way, that we look at all brown-skinned people the same and don't account for cultural differences, say, between a Mexican and a Salvadoran or somebody from Guatemala. And can you talk a little bit about maybe the perceptions of white culture?
Yes, I think it's always been black, white paradigm, because it's easier, it's less messy, and the civil rights movement was pretty much painted that way, that it was a black civil rights movement, which it was. They were the ones who led the way and sacrificed and gave their lives for it. But there were Native Americans, there were Asians, and even Latinos that were part of it. But I think they were not in significant numbers. And we got, I would say, described as Mexican or Chicano. It went from the 60s, 70s as Chicanos, and a lot of Central Americans were invisible, and many became Chicanos. That's what's actually fascinating, too. There's a lot of Central Americans that gave away their roots to fit in with the majority, which were Mexican Americans. And finally, till now, like now that they're in their 40s, 50s, 60s, more in the 50s, 60s age category, they're starting to recognize their Central American roots or their Salvadoran roots, because until the 80s, there was a big wave of Central Americans, and it was the largest immigration group because of the Civil Wars. And then what I've noticed is that three major Latino groups, Mexican-Americans, Cuban-Americans, and Puerto Ricans, are the ones that are represented through congressional members. But Central Americans have one to represent millions of people. But there hasn't been an identity. And I think that through my books, I'm trying to create that identity so that Salvadoran Americans won't be ashamed or embarrassed, because there is a shame and a stigma because of the gang issue and because of the 1980s civil wars, where people were ashamed to recognize their background. And when we're forced to become Mexican to get a job in downtown LA and other areas, because you have to change your accent to fit in. So white America is not purview. And also black America may not be aware of the nuances. But I think that Central Americans, we moved in the areas where the black community was. And that's a really fascinating dynamic. So we've learned to get along. And there's a lot of half black, half Central American kids. That's the new generation. They're half black, half Latino. And it's happening more.
It seems like you do advocate, though, for Latinos and African Americans to have a voice and to exercise their voting power. And it seems like one of your essays, which was a letter to the San Diego Union Tribune, was a really compelling plea for blacks and Latinos to work together to affect change.
Yes. So when I was working in Pasadena, because of the work I had done in South Central, I was able to take a proactive leadership approach to bring both communities together, even though people thought I was crazy, because nobody really does that, because it's too much work and it's too many headaches. But when it comes to organizing and doing coalition building and unifying the community, it's perceived as grunt work, and the police sometimes sees it as a threat, because if Black Lives Matter were to unite with the Latino social movement. It's perceived as troublemakers and is not seen as people trying to advocate to protect their children from being shot and killed, because there is that epidemic in the U.S. of black kids or young people and men being shot and killed indiscriminately. And it's a spillover of slavery, because the U.S. still has that original sin of slavery and also the mistreatment of immigrants. So it's similar. The slavery and the mistreatment of immigrants go hand in hand. So when you have two oppressed communities trying to work together, there's a lot of suspicion, and a lot of times the leaders become demonized because people cannot believe that someone truly cares about saving lives and having people get along and respect each other.
Do you think that you talk about leadership, and you know, I think about in the 60s and 70s and 80s in this country when we had a Martin Luther King or we had a Cesar Chavez. Is that the type of leadership that you're talking about on this kind of big stage type of leadership? Because it seems like right now we are suffering this crisis, and as Americans, I think it is kind of an identity crisis of never really resolving what you just called, I think, that original sin of slavery, and I think our immigration policies are an outgrowth of that. That maybe we are approaching a place where we can start dealing with all this.
Yes, and I think that Trump has forced people to come out of their comfort zones, because before, people could care less and they felt safe because Barack Obama was very, I would say, middle of the road, moderate, and he tried to appeal to both sides. So I think Trump is so blunt and disruptive that he's just shaken the hell out of both sides, Democrats and Republicans, because he's taking on his own party. So I think people are finally talking about immigration, and in a way, it has polarized our country. And we do need a leader or leaders that can bring both sides together, because that was the intent, really, of Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez. They were pretty thoughtful, I would say responsible leaders who weren't promoting hate or violence. They were trying to actually make changes in a positive way. It's just that, just like with Archbishop Monsignor Oscar Romero in El Salvador, he was seen as a troublemaker and as a rabble rouser and like a demon that was a communist. But he was the representative of the Catholic Church, and then they murdered him. And what's ironic, and I actually wrote about that, that the Catholic Church, who actually demonized him, have now embraced them to make him into a saint. So a lot of times with leaders like Malcolm X and others, while they're alive, society and certain systems hate them, and even their own people too, because Malcolm X was actually hated by a large portion of the black community. So once they're dead, then they become sanctified or made into saints. And I think it's a human thing, because people don't like it when someone is very outspoken and says the truth, because they get offended. And but I think that it needs to be done in a responsible manner, because Trump, he's actually creating more divisions, because he's so blunt that he instigates a lot of hatred and anger. And I think we need to counterbalance that. And I think that there hasn't emerged leaders like there used to be in the past. They may, because of the internet and social media now, because before, at least, there was some mystery to them, because they were not on Facebook, they were not on Twitter, they were not being recorded or taking pictures of 24/7. And now that's the problem. Now nothing is private or sacred. So leaders have a harder time competing with the celebrity-driven, monetized internet system. People who are actually doing the hard work in the community to counter poverty, racism, they're usually perceived as somewhat boring and also as a threat. Because once you start pinpointing the truths and the realities of how certain institutions benefit from a lot of this poverty and violence, then they don't like it. That's exactly what happened with the Occupy movement, mm-hmm. that they became somewhat effective, but then all of a sudden they disappeared and it did not continue. And then the question is, what happened? And I think those are important analysis to be made or questions.
Randy, you have spent your life as an activist. In fact, I think it's your second book that is called The Life of an Activist in the Front Lines. And you just a moment ago said that maybe people think activists are boring, but you are a hard worker. And it seems like over the course of your books, you have been trying to engage people and to push other people to action. And where do you get your drive from?
Okay, good question. sometimes I wonder, because I've been at it for a while now, it can have a toll on you. It can have a toll on one's body and soul and mind. I've seen a lot. I've been through a lot. I think what's driven me, it's probably all the violence and mistreatment that I saw when I was growing up. And then I saw apathy. That's what I saw. That was the main ingredient. When I went away to high school in Minnesota, I saw Rochester, Minnesota, and how beautiful and calm Rochester was. And I was like, why is it that this city is so beautiful and there's no drive-bys, there's no police shootings or killings? And then I was like, this should be done, or this should be the case in L.A. too, in Los Angeles and in the smaller cities. And I was wondering, why don't they take the time to learn or to try to replicate cities that are successful like that? So then when I went to Oxy, that's when I became very revolutionized and radicalized through reading and writing, because I started reading a lot of literature, because it opens your mind, it revolutionizes your way of thinking. You become a real critical thinker. And see, and that's what Oxy does, Occidental College. So then that's what's driven me. It's those inequities that I've seen and lived firsthand.
Randy, I want to thank you so much. Our time is running out here. I just quickly, though, want to ask you, you have three nonfiction books that talk about your life, that talk about activism, that encourage people to be activists. But then you have this one nonfiction book, and The Lives and Times of El Chipicho. Well, say that for me.
Yes, the fiction book is El Chipicho, means the kid or the little kid.
And it's a slender volume, and I picked it up thinking it was a children's book, and I found out rapidly that it really wasn't. It's a completely, seemingly different tone from your other books. And what caused you to go in this direction of writing kind of this fantastic book with this fantastic character at the center?
I think I wanted to break the chains of oppression and write a novel. And then I did not know that you can write or say anything in a novel in fiction. And once I found out that you could, then I said, okay.
Then you did.
I'm going to say what El Chipicho has lived and what he plans to do to overcome all these obstacles.
Yes.
And to, even though he was bad, because, yes, in the book I make him into that he was a gangster.
Yes.
But then he comes as the little kids came on the buses, trains, walking from Central America through Mexico to the U.S. And then I decided to make him into a little hero that he's like an anti-hero. He's evil, but then he repents, and then he runs for mayor of L.A. He represents the corruption in politics because people think that that's the way to make changes. But we've seen it time and time and again that they get into politics, they become corrupt because power corrupts. And all they care and want is money and power. So then he runs for president, and I describe how he gets the white poor vote, how he gets the black, Asian, Latino, all votes to win. And he becomes the first Latino U.S. president. And I make him into a little hero because we don't have indigenous, dark-skinned heroes. Because I always see students worshiping Captain America, Superman, Batman, Spider-Man. They're all white. So I was like, we need to have our own little hero. So I said, El Cipitillo could be our hero. Even though it's in a very ghetto, urban, gangster kind of a character, it reflects a lot of our corporate CEOs. That's how they are. They're ruthless. They kill people to get what they want. So he's very synonymous to the corruption in our society. But then I try to make him good because he's fighting inner demons that he inherited from his mom and his dad. And I'm trying to send a message of hope and nonviolence. Because at the end, I don't want to give it away, but
let's just say there's transformation.
Yes.
Yes. Well, Randy Hirado Ertel, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. And for your latest book is In the Struggle Chronicles, and it's in Spanish and in English. And I thank you and want to encourage you to keep up the good work and to keep inspiring us.
Well, thank you very much, Susanne. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That was my conversation with Randy Hirado Ertel. His last name is Ertll, and his latest book is In the Struggles. Earlier, we spoke with Jamie B. Hansen on her book, Expanding the Conversation. Thank you, Randy and Jamie. I also thank our engineer, Anthony Garcia, and Mark Prell and Sean Knight for production assistance. A Novel Idea is a production of KRCB and Lit Radio. Listen online at krcb.org, subscribe to our podcast, and listen when and how you like. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. It's A Novel Idea.